Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Whip Clements. Appreciate that. The Pandemics and Public Emergencies Committee will come to order. DJ, will you please call the roll?
Chair Leak.
Here.
Vice Chair Payne.
Here.
Ranking Member Casello.
Here.
Representatives Bell has been excused. Byrd.
Here.
Clemens.
Here.
Driscoll.
Here.
Gilombardo.
Here.
Goff Marcil.
Here.
Jenny.
Here.
Mariano.
Here.
McFarland.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Thompson. Thompson. Tribulsi.
Here.
Williamson.
Here.
Zika. Zika. A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, DJ. I want to remind everyone to please silence their cell phones. Before we get started today, I would like to welcome and introduce the Pandemics and Public Emergency Committee Policy Chief, Ms. Karen Dearden. She will be officially joining us next week. Ms. Dearden has been chosen as Policy Chief to lead the House Committee on Pandemics and Public Emergencies. With experience across multiple state agencies, including the Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulation, Visit Florida, the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, the Florida Department of Transportation, the Executive Office of the Governor, and the Florida Senate. She most recently served as Communications Director at DBPR and worked throughout the pandemic to inform the public and regulated industries on emergency orders. Welcome, Ms. Dearden. Also assisting us today is Jordan Jones, Policy Chief for Civil Justice and Property Rights Subcommittee. On today's agenda, we have the consideration of one bill, HB 7, Civil Liability for Damages Relating to COVID-19, by Representative McClure. Representative McClure, you are recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Leak and Committee. I'm pleased to present House Bill 7, Civil Liability for Damages Relating to COVID. The novel coronavirus pandemic has significantly impacted nearly every Floridian, including the business community. This bill aims to reduce the threat of potential civil liability for COVID-19 related claims. House Bill 7 will protect business entities, educational institutions, religious institutions, and governmental entities acting in good faith. This bill is intended to give clarity to Florida businesses that if they are making a good faith effort to comply with regulations, that they will not have the cloud of potential frivolous litigation hanging over their head. That is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative McClure. Are there questions on the bill? Members, are there questions on the bill? Representative Jenny, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you. And also, I want to make sure that I publicly thank Representative McClure for reaching out to me. I appreciate that greatly, sir. And I know the members of my caucus do as well. My question is, and I may have a follow-up, but we'll deal with that when we get there. My question is dealing with line 141. In the bill, it states that a judge will determine if a defendant, and I quote, made a good faith effort to substantially comply with health standards. I could not find a definition in the bill for good faith effort. So my first question, Rep, is what does good faith effort actually mean?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Representative. I look forward to talking to you some more after committee, but as it goes to good faith, simply put, the defendant tried. I mean, I think in this once in a 100-year pandemic, good faith effort has evolved since March 2020. So the defendant is trying to stay in compliance with local, state, or federal regulations as it relates to the health and safety of their businesses.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Jenny. Representative McClure, if you could move that mic a little closer to your mouth, I'd appreciate it. Representative Jenny, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my second question revolves around that same idea of good faith effort. If a business owner were to say simply, look, I knew about rules A, B, D, E, F, G, but I didn't know about rule C. If that business says, I didn't know about that rule, is their ignorance to that particular rule a valid total defense under this bill?
Representative McClure.
Thank you, Chair. So, you know, I think it goes to the timetable, right? I mean, the fact pattern in March for a COVID case or a business is different in March of 2020, say, than in January of 2021, right? So I think what we're going to hear is that if the business at the time of the case was making a good faith effort to comply, and you know, I don't want to give an example, but to your statement, simply omitted one of 100 things. No, we're not going to the gotchas, right? We're going to the you know, we're giving the businesses the comfort that if they're trying their absolute hardest, that if they have a healthy and safe work environment and they're trying to comply with guidance, that they don't have to have the anxiety and fear of civil liability.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair,
if I may. If I could jump in there real quick, Representative Jenny. I think the, you know, the lawyers on the panel will tell you that you know, good faith effort will be determined by the fact finder based on the unique facts and circumstances of that particular matter. So I think it would be difficult to give an absolute answer to that, but it would be left to those people who had spent the time reviewing this specific case.
Okay.
And with that, Representative Jenny, you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. One other thing, and then I'll wrap up here so some other members can ask some questions. But if this hypothetical business had been in the past cited for violating a state or local COVID emergency order, would that information be admissible if there were a lawsuit?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Again, I mean, I would have to understand more about what that citation looked like, right? I mean, is it a wholesale they didn't try at all? Is it just one out of 100? And again, to the Chair's point on the previous question, I think that's what the process is for, right? So, but yeah, it would be a function of the fact pattern at that given time overlaid with regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative.
And I'll jump in there again, too. Admissibility will also be determined by the judge based on the specific facts and circumstances of the case. Representative Clemens, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. thank you for bringing this good bill forward, Representative McClure. And I've just got one question, and if the chair allows the germanity of this. There's been a lot of misunderstanding or either misrepresentation of what this bill is and what it is not. For the layperson like myself who is not an attorney, I have to discern between the emails that I get for this bill and the ones against this bill. If you could quickly, summarily, very quickly say what this bill does, and then from all of the emails that you have received too, what this bill does not do, so that you can you can set aside and lower the relationship or the angst that some people have about what this bill is not.
Representative McClure, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And you know, we've worked together on multiple issues where, you know good and well I'm not an attorney as well, so I'll try my best to put it in a layman's terms. But this bill simply reduces the anxiety of fear that businesses in the state of Florida that are trying their level best and have throughout this pandemic. This bill goes to reduce the fear of potential liability as a function of COVID. What this bill doesn't do is a whole bunch of things, right? But I think maybe some of the greatest examples or to your point, emails that we've received, you know, workers' comp has been discussed, employee protections, those sorts of things. This bill doesn't touch that specifically, although I would say incentivizing good behavior, right, by saying, hey, look, do your best. Follow the recommendations and the guidance of the folks that we subscribe to as being experts in the, you know, on a high level. You know, if you're doing those things, you don't have to worry about that. And through that, you have a healthy and safe work environment, and those are all good things.
Representative Costello, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, I'll come right out and say this. I think this bill is a bill with the right ideas. Concept is good. I just think that the wording needs to be looked at and scrutinized. My question to you is, between the pre-suit proceeding and the requirement that a physician assess to something they probably cannot reasonably determine, raising the degree of negligence and standard of proof, I'm having a hard time imagining anyone will be able to successfully bring a COVID liability claim under your bill. So my question to you is, can you walk us through a specific example of a claim that you believe would be able to make it through these procedural barriers and meet this high standard?
Representative McClure, you recognize?
Thank you, Chair. So I've heard a couple of things in there. I kind of want to maybe square them up, right? So the hurdles on the front side that we've talked about and with the affidavit process, that sort of thing. Let's start there because that's where it would start, right? So you would have, a plaintiff that would obviously seek legal advice, would be put in touch with a physician to evaluate the situation. Through that, the physician would make a reasonable a determination based off of reasonable medical certainty that the patient contracted COVID from that place, and the affidavit would be signed. You go into the court process. As it relates to the gross negligence and clear and convincing heightened standards, I won't run from that. That's exactly what we want to do. We want to increase the standard. No, I don't think it's impossible to navigate its way through the process. There's higher standards in that.
Thank you. Ranking Member Casella for a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. My next question would be, have we have any physician testimony asserting that this could work as far as getting an affidavit from a physician? And my second part of that question would be, what about the law part of it, a lawyers? How are they feeling about this? Have you inquired to these two groups about this bill here and what the procedures would be? Thank you, Chair.
Representative McClure, just to answer the first part of your question, obviously we've not had any physician testimony today. There may have been testimony in other committees, but I think he's generally asking, have you consulted with the stakeholders? You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Yeah, absolutely, I have. I think, although not exactly like MedMal, it has, this process, this affidavit process lends itself a little bit to that. I've talked to the medical community, doctors, et cetera, and yeah, they it's kind of a little bit like everything else with COVID. Some have concerns, some say it's good, some say it's overboard, et cetera. Same with attorneys that I've spoken with. So my pledge to you, and we've talked, is let's continue to work on it, right? I'm not anchored 100% to any of the specific language in the bill. I'm anchored to the thesis of what this bill does. So I appreciate you recognizing that the intent of this bill is trying to arrive at the same place, and how we get there is what we're going to discuss, and to that end, I pledge to continue to working with you.
Thank you, Ranking Member. Representative Driscoll for a question. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you, Rep. McClure. Thank you so much. I echo the sentiments of my colleagues. Thank you for taking the time to talk about the bill. And I know you and I have talked a lot about the affidavit, and I wanted to ask some questions about that today. It's that requirement for those who are following along is like around line 131 or so of the bill. So on that line, there's a requirement to have a physician affidavit that attests that the plaintiff had COVID-19 related damages as a result of a defendant's acts or omissions, and that it has to happen concurrently to filing a claim. So how is any claimant going to get a physician to attest that the physician, to attest to that without the physician being shown discovery to base the attestation on?
Representative McClure, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for all the dialogue, Representative Driscoll. I think, we've had great progress on the affidavit front and look to continue to work on it. As it specifically goes to how I envision it working, it would be, I would imagine that the plaintiff would seek legal guidance. They would put them in touch with a doctor, not unlike MedMal. That fact pattern would be, communicated to the medical or to the physician rather. And through that, they would make a determination if they feel comfortable signing the affidavit.
Representative Driscoll for a follow-up.
Thank you. Isn't it more of the judge or jury's job to determine if the damage or the injury or the death was caused by the defendant rather than a doctor?
Representative McClure.
Try that again, Representative, if you don't mind.
Wouldn't that, Mr. Chair, thank you. Wouldn't that be more in the purview of the judge or the jury to try to determine that causation? We're asking under the bill as drafted for a physician to do that. Wouldn't that determination be up to the judge or jury or the finder of fact, if you will?
Representative McClure, if you can, and you're forgiven for not being a lawyer, but give it a shot.
Thank you. I don't know that forgiveness is what I need. A round of applause.
You're not recognized anymore. Just kidding. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the judge and the jury do play a role in this, and I think they do. They are the ultimate decision maker. So I guess that's where my confusion perhaps is. But as it relates to the affidavit side of things, I don't think it's uncommon for a physician, in ordinary course of business today, to follow a fact pattern or look at medical records, those sorts of things, of their patient, and through that make a determination.
Representative Driscoll, you recognize.
Thank you. And that question was, you're right, it's tough. I know you're not a lawyer. You did a good job trying to work through it. Why is the physician making a determination about where someone contracted COVID-19? Isn't that better for an epidemiologist or contact tracer?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative. I've struggled with this, admittedly, on who best, right? You know, epidemiologist, maybe on first pass seems like, you know, it's maybe the right fit. I don't know that, you know, we had conversations in the previous committee. I've had conversations with staff and colleagues. Inaccessibility is something that continues to come up, something we've discussed. So I don't know that an epidemiologist, I don't know that I know an epidemiologist, but I do know a doctor. And striking that balance between expertise and accessibility is what I'm going to. Again, open to suggestions, open to dialogue to try and find the perfect fit.
Representative Driscoll for a follow-up.
Thank you. I'm going to try to take a run at that question I'd asked before about the judge or jury, but just kind of approach it in a different way. And the setup for it is this. Under the bill as currently drafted, there's a situation where a physician would be providing an affidavit that attests a certain facts or just, you know, says that certain things are true. That's what affidavits do. And the physician would be doing this, as I understand it, before this discovery process happens, where there can be evidence put forth about whether the defendant acted in good faith. And so I guess the question is, because typically when there's the discovery, right, like there's the opportunity for the judge or jury to decide what to do with that, and that's the case here. It's like you want this discovery provided, and the judge can make a determination. But we're not given that same kind of a setup to the physician. We're asking the physician to do that affidavit before there's discovery. So maybe another way to think about this is, why are we having the physician do that before there's discovery? Shouldn't they only be required to provide such an affidavit after they've had an opportunity to look at information and try to evaluate all the facts?
Okay, it's the same question, but go ahead. Yeah, you're recognized.
I got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So two things. I think before I get to, I think what the meat of that question is, which is the logistical, the cadence per se of that, let's stop and talk about the belief of reasonable medical certainty, right? That's not, they're not anchored to 100%. It's just based off of the facts that the patient has provided them. They feel, reasonably medically certain, not 100%, not 1,000%, right? But reasonably medically certain based off of the belief of the fact pattern. So that's step one, right? And that would be based off of the patient's description of the fact pattern during that time. As it relates to the cadence of this, I don't know that I subscribe to the notion that the doctor is going to be left in wonderment about the goings, you know, coming and going of their patient, because I would imagine that they would have sought, you know, the patient would have sought legal advice, and that's how they would have understood this affidavit process to, you know, kind of need to take place. And through that, information would be exchanged through all parties. I don't know if I'm clearing that up or making it worse for you, but I understand your logistical question, but I don't see the challenge inherently in it.
Are you done? Okay, thank you. Representative Thompson for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, if that is allowable.
Yes, you may proceed.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Representative McClure. My question focuses on access to the courts, and I'd like to know how this bill would square with the Constitution that says that the courts shall be open to every person for redress of any injury, and justice shall be administered without sale, denial, or delay. How would this bill square with that? Because you have a pre-suit requirement for the affidavit, and if you don't get that, you're not allowed to proceed.
Representative McClure, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think that's without precedent, though. We do that in other areas of law. So I'm not the non-attorney coming here putting forward new procedures and processes. You see that in other areas of law, like Med-Mal. I will also add, though, that I think whenever you have an overpowering public necessity, this body, the legislature, has a responsibility, certainly an obligation, to take a look at that. And that's what we're doing here. So, you know, it's a once in a 100-year pandemic. It's not normal course of business. It's not every day. And to that end, it requires a once in a 100-year conversation, which I believe we're having. But it's not without precedent. And I think that's important.
Representative Thompson, you're recognized.
Thank you. And your comment that it's an overpowering public necessity, does that mean then that all civil cases, and I agree with you that this is a 100-year kind of situation with the pandemic, but does this mean now that all civil cases, such as contract issues or business interruption, would have to now have the physician's affidavit?
Representative McClure, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, this bill doesn't go to contract law or those. No.
Representative Thompson for a follow-up.
Thank you. And my final question, what is the incentive then if there's no accountability, no liability, what is the incentive for the business to follow the guidelines?
Representative McClure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that I follow. I'll do my best. This bill goes to incentivizing good behavior. It clearly says if you're operating in good faith, then that's the intent of the bill. If you're not, that's exactly the punishment that would perhaps be before you, or the repercussions of those decisions. You would be liable.
Final question.
Representative Thompson, you're recognized.
Thank you. So the business would be liable is that what you just said, if they do not follow the guidelines?
Representative McClure.
Let me also clarify, it would be, you know, from the date the bill presumably was signed into law, but assuming that, obviously, for sake of conversation, yes, the framework of this bill would be the law of the land, and if you're operating within the framework of that, then yeah, you would be, that's the intent of the bill. If you're not, then the civil justice system would, you know, run its course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. And, you know, for the point of clarification, you don't get the benefit of your good faith efforts unless you effort in good faith. So I think that probably would address that issue. Representative Smith for a question.
Thank you, Chair Leak, for giving us the opportunity to ask these questions. And Representative McClure, thank you for your dialogue with me about the bill so far. I want to just kind of continue on what Representative Thompson was saying about, I guess, the overwhelming public necessity, because what keeps happening around conversations around this bill is the comparison to med malpractice. And how, you know, we have pre-court findings in Med-Mal, and we ask doctors to sign affidavits in Med-Mal as well. What is the overwhelming public necessity for there to be this pre-trial affidavit in this case?
Representative McClure, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the overwhelming public necessity for the affidavit is the question. I'm saying the liability protection is the overwhelming public necessity. So maybe I can clear that up for you. But as it relates to the affidavit, I want there to be some weight on the front side of this. Although our courthouses aren't packed today, I'm not trying to solve for that. I'm trying to solve, as we discussed multiple times, for the fear and anxiety of our business community. And I can assure you, as I go through my district, and I represent an agriculturally heavy district, our small businesses, it looks a lot like middle America. There's a tremendous fear. But then back out of that and go to places like Miami or Tampa just down the road, and your larger businesses are scared as well. And so that's what this bill is trying to solve for, Representative.
Permission for follow-up, Chair?
Yep, Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Leak. And thank you, Representative McClure. So as we're talking about the overwhelming public necessity, I understand the anxiety that businesses have around the potential for litigation or the fear of litigation. When we're talking about MedMal, the overwhelming public necessity is the fact that doctors cannot find malpractice insurance. They can't afford malpractice insurance because of frivolous litigation. When we're talking about overwhelming public necessity in MedMal, we're talking about higher costs for patients because of frivolous litigation, as opposed to just fears and anxiety. And around that point, specifically, my understanding is in MedMal, doctors are required to sign an affidavit for the purpose of medical findings. You know, a doctor used the wrong type of stitch in a surgery. Who would know that they used the wrong type of stitch? A doctor. The doctor signs an affidavit saying for this type of surgery, this is not appropriate. This caused my client damages. It's a medical finding. What are the medical findings that we're asking a doctor to attest to by signing an affidavit as proposed in your bill?
Representative McClure.
Thank you, Chair. So I'll go to that first, but I think there's an overarching question that maybe I can help solve for. So they're asking for the medical expertise on the fact pattern of the patient, where they were, what the situation was, what their circumstance, you know, what the circumstance was at the time. And through that, do they have a belief of reasonable medical certainty that they contracted COVID from there because of those actions or inactions, right? So that's the medical expertise component to the affidavit. But I think when you go to the greater public necessity, we're talking about Florida's economy. We're talking about businesses that have been teetering through this pandemic, not unlike everybody, quite frankly. And so the greater public necessity is not having courthouses packed with sue and settles or frivolous lawsuits. It's to put paint on the field that clearly defines that if you are operating in good faith, if you're trying to stay within the ever-changing regulatory framework, and we've, I would suggest, stabilized. You know, I think March, April, May, June of 2020, guidance was pretty fluid as we started to understand this more. Today, in February 2021, it's a little more standardized. I think we have our arms wrapped around a little bit better. I would never suggest that I'm a medical expert. But if you're trying, if you're keeping up, if you're trying to have a healthy and safe place of business, that is, those are the people we're trying to solve for, if that makes sense.
Thank you for that. And permission for a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and I'm trying to understand the requirement of a doctor and how realistic it is to expect a doctor to be willing to sign off on an affidavit that attests to both medical findings and non-medical findings. So what's clear in your bill is that the medical finding that they'd be attesting to is, well, I mean, essentially confirming that the plaintiff has tested positive for COVID, which is, you know, something that's very easy to prove that probably other professionals, in addition to a medical doctor, would be able to affirm and possibly sign off on as an alternative. But also, we're asking them, and I'm checking for my understanding, to sign off on non-medical findings such that the damages, injury, or death occurred as a result of the defendant's acts or omissions. Is it the intent of the bill that the doctor does not really investigate the activity of the plaintiff or verify the activity or behaviors of the plaintiff before signing off on that affidavit? Is it as simple as the plaintiff telling the doctor, I went to this establishment, there was negligence, I contracted COVID afterwards, and it's their fault?
Representative McClure, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Well, is it as simple as that? I think it's part of the simplicity of that, certainly. Yeah, I think that's almost all the way there. I think I would round out that conversation by saying, well, have you been anywhere else that you thought was unsafe or not following guidelines? You know, there's a whole host of questions that I think the doctor would have that would also, in my opinion, be a part of an ordinary examination in this situation.
Permission for one last question, Mr.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you. Appreciate it. So what you and thank you, Representative McClure. It appears that what you just explained and described are still, I think they're common sense, but they're not medical findings. So my question, going back to, I guess, the intent of the bill, you know, for this once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, why is it that the bill does not sunset? Why is it that the bill, once it becomes law, essentially goes on forever, as opposed to just being a temporary opportunity to be able to shield businesses from liability during this temporary pandemic?
Representative McClure, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Call me an optimist, Representative. I hope COVID doesn't go on forever. And the mere fact that the title of the bill is, you know, has COVID liability in it, right, was kind of my thought. I suppose I hadn't particularly pondered that, but I'd love to talk to you more about it, as I would the affidavit process. I'm sincere in my pledge to work with any and everyone who can fortify the affidavit process. I want there to be weight. I want there to be gravity on the front side of this. Our business has been through a lot in this state. Our economy has been through a lot in this state. For those that are trying their level best, I want to give them assurances. I'm not saying that this bill is the cure-all for all problems related to COVID. It's fractional. It's a sliver. But to that end, I want to be a part of that solution. So I hope we can continue to work together.
Thank you, Representative McClure. Members, are there any more questions on the bill? Seeing no more questions on the bill, are there any amendments? We have an amendment. We'll now take up amendment barcode 068809. Representative Driscoll, you are recognized to explain the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment, though short, is attempting to be impactful and to amend the affidavit process that we've talked about quite a bit today. What the amendment would do would change it so that the affiant or the person providing the affidavit would not be limited to a physician. It could be any medical professional qualified to testify on an individual's COVID-19 status. It does maintain the requirement that that medical professional has to be licensed in the state of Florida. It also changes the word plaintiff to person whose injury or death gave rise to the act, because in the event of the death, the plaintiff would not be the, it'd be someone other than the person who passed away from COVID, someone other than the decedent. And it limits the scope of affidavit testimony to whether or not the person had COVID during the time period relevant to the complaint, which would be the appropriate scope for testimony for a medical expert. And that, Mr. Chair, is the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Members, are there questions on the amendment? Representative Smith, for a question on the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Leek, and thank you, Representative Driscoll, for bringing this forward. So going back to my questions of the sponsor about medical versus non-medical findings, would the impact of your amendment be that the doctor is no longer required to sign an affidavit that includes non-medical findings?
Representative Driscoll, you're recognized.
Thank you. It would try to focus on the certainty that the person who was injured or who died was infected with COVID at that time, so it would narrow those findings that they're required to make.
Members, are there any other questions? I have a question. Representative Fiscal, what is the definition of licensed medical expert?
That's a great question. I should look it up to see if it's a term of art. But what the intent of the amendment, I guess, is twofold. The first is, of course, to make sure that it's somebody who's licensed in the state of Florida. One of the things that Chair McClure and I talked about yesterday was, you know, what if I'm someone who doesn't go see a medical doctor in terms of a physician? What if I go see a PA, a physician's assistant, or an RN? So is there a way to broaden the definition that might be reflective of what actual Floridians actually encounter in terms of their medical care? So that is part of the intent. And then the other part of it is with respect to finding an expert. It would just be someone who is perhaps in the course of their business and practices more used to reviewing medical records and preparing documents with respect to legal cases.
Thank you. I'll recognize myself for a follow-up.
You are recognized.
Thank you. What are the qualifications of becoming an expert? Because in our practices in the legal world, expert has a very specific meaning, and a qualified expert has a very specific process. I don't see that here. What is intended in this amendment with regard to what qualifies someone as an expert?
Am I recognized?
You're recognized, Dan.
So it's I think you raised a good question about that as well, and just it kind of points out some of the issues and kind of flaws that I see in this bill and problems with the process, right? And like in trying to solve for this issue of having a physician do it and broadening it to be reflective, then you raise this whole point about medical expert. Like all of this procedurally is just kind of wonky. I think the bill would be much better just to take the affidavit portion of it out, frankly. But you're right. In order to qualify as an expert, there typically has to be testimony that's put on before a judge, so perhaps that's something that could be worked out in the amendment to have the person actually qualify as an expert. But then that also speaks to the whole complication of this bill with having a trial before a trial. It probably should just be a trial process, in which case that could take place in the natural flow of things, but unfortunately that's not the bill that we've been given. So,
thank you, members. Are there any more questions? Seeing no more questions, we'll move on to public testimony. William Large, you're recognized to speak on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a second.
I'm William Large. I'm the president of the Florida Judiciary.
I'm sorry, on the amendment. Let me be clear. Recognized to speak on the amendment.
Yes, sir. I'm William Large, president of the Florida Justice Reform Institute. Unfortunately, Representative Driscoll, we rise to speak in opposition to your amendment. Back in the day, I used to be a medical malpractice defense attorney, and we are governed by a pre-suit process under Florida Statute 766-102, where both the defendant and I used to represent hospitals and doctors in medical malpractice cases. We had to have a physician sign an affidavit to say that there was appropriate defenses for defending the case, and the plaintiff, indeed, had a burden to have an affidavit signed to say that there was a deviation from the appropriate standard of care. So there is a process already in our Florida statutes where there is an affidavit used at a preliminary stage. In that preliminary stage, the plaintiff's attorney has certain information. He has the testimony from his client. He knows certain facts. So it's not that difficult with that limited set of facts to get a physician to sign an affidavit. Yes, in the future, if the case goes on, there will be deposition testimony. Evidence will be entered regarding policies, procedures, protocols. There'll be requests for admissions, answers for interrogatories, and more discovery will be developed over time. But I don't see that an affidavit process initially is a prohibition on being able to bring a lawsuit, because that process works today in Florida's pre-suit process under Florida Statute 766-102. And the big thing that your amendment, Representative Driscoll, would be getting rid of would be on lines 135 and 136, quote, occurred as a result of the defendant's acts or omissions, end of quote. Your amendment would just bring it to a standard that someone had tested positive for COVID-19 and wouldn't look at the liability fact patterns. Since this is already done for our pre-suit process under medical malpractice cases, I think it would be something that a plaintiff's attorney would be able to comply with, and I don't see it as a violation of access to courts, so we stand in opposition to Representative Driscoll's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Large. Members, are there any questions of Mr. Large? Mr. Large, Representative Driscoll, you have a question. Yes. Recognize.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Large. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
Could you talk a little bit about your analysis in which you find medical malpractice cases analogous to these potential COVID-19 liability claims? Because that's a bridge that I've not been able to make. To me, it does not seem like an apples-to-apples comparison. It seems like apples to oranges. Whereas medical malpractice, that is a physician attesting to the acts or omissions of another physician and looking at those medical records, whereas what we have now, and I know we're on my amendment, but the bill, as I understand it, is having a physician attest to facts that are not, it doesn't have anything to do with treatment. It's actually trying to attest to causation, which that's what, you know, I think is such an issue with this bill. But maybe you could help us understand how you make that comparison.
Mr. Large, you're recognized.
Sure. So, Representative Driscoll, up until the late 1980s, you could file a medical malpractice lawsuit in Florida just by filing the complaint. In the late 1980s, the Florida legislature said, there is something more. We want to create an additional burden. And we want to create this pre-suit process. We want to make the state of Florida, the litigation for medical malpractice cases, different. And one of the reasons was because of the increased litigation patterns against doctors and hospitals. So as the policymaking branch of government, the legislature said, we're going to add this pre-suit process on top of medical malpractice cases. So I draw the analogy that you all as the policymaking branch of government have seen a crisis, and you, through this legislation, have decided we're going to increase, create another step, and that's that affidavit process. So if it was done in medical malpractice cases, it can be done in cases like this. And that's why I'm drawing the analogy with medical malpractice.
Thank you, Mr. Large.
Thank you. Thank you.
We also have the appearance of Carrie Boyd waving in support. Is there any debate on the amendment? Representative Smith, you're recognized for debate on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Driscoll, for bringing forward this really thoughtful amendment. I think it's thoughtful for a number of reasons, you know, because what we're doing here is we're creating a situation where the doctor would be signing the affidavit on strictly medical findings, not non-medical findings. The way the bill is currently written is it says that the doctor is attesting to that the plaintiff's COVID-19 related damages, injury, or death occurred as a result of the defendant's acts or omissions. How does the doctor know that the defendant's actions or omissions caused this damage? Is the doctor an investigator? Are they going to go out and collect evidence that proves what the plaintiff told them is accurate? You know, we keep making this comparison to medical malpractice, and I just want to underscore again, in med mal cases, first of all, there is a compelling public interest and public necessity. That necessity being that doctors can't get malpractice insurance, they can't afford it, and frivolous lawsuits are contributing to increased patient costs. What we're being told here is that the overwhelming public necessity is fear and anxiety of something that is not currently happening. And we're actually requiring the doctor to sign off on things that they don't know anything about, that they're just taking what the plaintiff has told them at face value. What Representative Driscoll's amendment does is it limits what the doctor is signing off to just be about, yes, the plaintiff tested positive for COVID during the time period here in question. And I think that this is a really sensible way to clean up the many concerns that we've put forward about the doctor's affidavit process, and I would urge members of the committee to vote yes on this amendment. Thank you.
Representative Thompson, in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the whole as to what we're talking about here. And I think that Representative Driscoll's very good amendment would improve the bill substantially. The other concern that I have, without this amendment, you're asking the physician to determine if the business put forth a good faith effort to meet the standards. Well, what standards are you talking about? I'm from Orange County, where we have standards that were imposed by our county mayor, by our city mayor, where there were no standards at the state level. So what standard would the business be held to? And as I commented before, I'm very concerned about access to the courts and without physicians, and there's been no testimony, as I heard earlier, that physicians are willing to sign this affidavit, then we have a constitutional right in terms of access to the courts that people would be deprived of. So Representative Driscoll's very good amendment is something that would improve your legislation, I believe, Representative McClure, and I hope that others would support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Members, any further debate? I'll recognize myself again for a little debate. And, you know, after 20-plus years of practice, I can tell you there are no shortage of experts out there to say what needs to be said on either side of the case. Plaintiffs and defendants alike hire doctors, and not medical malcases, but in personal injury cases. And doctors are not only able to tell you what the injury was with a degree of specificity, they are able to tell you what the cause of that injury was, and the other expert stands up and says it was something different. In fact, these experts are so good, they can look at a pre-existing injury and tell you whether the current injury aggravated it or was distinct from it. So what this bill does in itself, as it is in its original form, is not inconsistent with how practice happens today. And I would urge you all to oppose the amendment. Representative Driscoll, would you like to close on the amendment?
I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So as to the question about medical expert, I thank Mr. Large for bringing Section 766.102 to my attention, because there actually is a definition of medical expert in there. A person may not give expert testimony concerning, and this is in subsection 5 of that statute, the professional standard of care unless the person is a healthcare provider who holds an active and valid license and conducts a complete review of the pertinent medical records and meets certain criteria. You know, they must be a specialist, or if they're a specialist, they must have certain criteria. They must either be an instructor or in a clinical research program. So I think there are some examples that we can look to from that statute with respect to how we define medical expert. But I think the comparisons stop right about there. I think Rep. Smith hit on some really good points, and Rep. Thompson as well, about why what is happening with this proposed bill with HB 7 is not quite analogous to medical malpractice. We have not heard of a groundswell of cases or floodgates opening with respect to these cases, and I think it's likely that we would not, and that makes it different than medical malpractice for that reason. You know, and I mentioned before, I do appreciate Representative McClure reaching out to so many of us and trying to talk through the bill. This is an attempt to try to get to a place maybe where this bill can truly have some bipartisan support. I think that it makes the bill much better because it doesn't put our physicians in a place where they are in so many ways acting like a judge and a jury. And by the way, they're doing this by providing this affidavit in a pretrial trial process without having all of the facts. And so for those reasons, I would encourage you to vote up on this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Having closed on her amendment, I will now turn to the vote. All in favor of the amendment say yay.
Yay.
All opposed say nay.
Nay.
Show the amendment failed. Feels like it failed. Now we're back on the bill. Is there any public testimony on the bill? If I see two hands, we can do a roll call. Okay. Seeing two hands, DJ, please call the roll on the amendment.
Representatives Bell, excused, Byrd?
No.
Casello?
Yes.
Clemens?
No.
Driscoll?
Yes.
Gilombardo?
No.
Goff-Marcil?
Yes.
Jenny?
Yes.
Mariano? McFarland?
No.
Payne?
No.
Smith?
Yeah.
Snyder?
No.
Thompson?
Yeah.
Tribulsi?
No.
Williamson?
No.
Zika?
No.
Chair Leak?
No.
Six yeas, 11 nays.
I thought my ears heard it right. Thank you. Now we'll move to public testimony on the bill. So members, we are back on the bill. This is public testimony. First is Richard Templin, Florida AFL-CIO. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you. So my job in this process is to try to be here and share the perspective of working people, of workers on this issue. And I got to say, I don't relish the role of always being the guy that's peeing in the punch bowl. But we really haven't talked about how this is impacting workers or how it could impact workers. We keep hearing that businesses struggled with different mandates and different regulations. I'm sorry, I don't remember that at all. We had very little regulation in this process. There were some shutdowns, of course, and there was some limited, but let's not forget our reopening, the state of Florida reopening plan, was at complete odds with the CDC guidelines for how states should reopen. I mean, we didn't even do it right. We were throwing people together and letting them mix and mingle all across the state, and we saw what happened. Now, working people saw this, and they saw it as kind of a Wild West approach. And they had no choice. They had to keep their jobs if they could. They had to put food on the table. They had to keep a roof over their kids' heads. And so if they were fortunate enough to be covered by a collective bargaining agreement, and you know, we represent 1.3 million people across the state. If they were fortunate enough to be in a union, they were able to go and collectively bargain with their employer. But what we found across the state was, hey, can we reduce the number of people working together? Can we stagger shifts? No, it's a disruption to business. Can we get some PPE? No, it's too expensive. Can we reduce customer traffic? In some cases, yes, but it was usually no unless we have to. Can we have a mask mandate? No. Still no mask mandate in the state of Florida. So these workers tried to negotiate and tried to work with their employers to put the safety protocols in place so that they and the consumers would be safe. And in too many cases, they were unsuccessful in doing that. In some cases, they were. I don't believe that anyone that's supporting this legislation, well, anyone here supporting this legislation has any bad intentions. I think Representative McClure has been great speaking with us. He took some of our ideas into consideration. And I think that everybody's trying to do the right thing, but I think we're just missing the point from a working person's perspective. Now, we're being told that this will root out the bad actors, like, you know, folks who did everything right will be covered. But where does it say that? How does the bill define bad actors? How are they singled out? As Representative Jenny asked in questions, what is a good faith effort? What if there's a collective bargaining agreement between the workers and the management, and management breaks that agreement? Is that still considered a good faith effort? It's not specified. All we know is that in so many cases, working people have risked their lives and the lives of their families during this pandemic. And we're being told, and they're seeing this, they're really concerned about this. We're being told that we have to pass this blanket immunity, which is in essence what it is, and I think the questions have borne that out, but that we have to pass this to help keep, you know, keep the business climate good in the state of Florida. Our members are just super concerned about this because they feel like they did everything that they were supposed to do, especially because they didn't have a choice. And again, I think it's ironic, and I've said this in other stops, that the very first measure dealing directly with the COVID pandemic that is being considered is blanket immunity for big corporations. It's not help for small businesses. It's not help for communities. It's this immunity language. We so appreciate the intentionality of the bill sponsor and the folks that are sponsoring this legislation. Our members need a stable business climate. Workers need businesses to succeed. We are just really concerned that this is the wrong approach, and we hope that, if anything, you can just put the brakes on a little bit and we can explore a little more. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Templin. David Sirdar, speaking for himself. Barbara Devane, for the Florida National Organization for Women. Sorry, she's an opponent. Carolyn Johnson for the Florida Chamber of Commerce. You're recognized. Ms. Johnson and members, we're approaching, coming up on 1 hour left in the meeting, so we want to make sure we reserve time for debate and anything else we may need to do, and that everyone has a fair chance to speak. So if we could move these along, I would appreciate it. Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative McClure, for bringing this good bill forward. There's a lot of discussion about the public necessity surrounding this bill, and what I want to point out is that it's not that these cases are, you know, going to go to trial and that a lot of these cases will be won in court. It's the money and the amount of time that's going to be spent by these businesses that are keeping business owners up at night and could potentially be putting business owners out of business as a series of lawsuits come forward, despite them trying to do the right thing. Another thing that I'd like to point out is that there is accountability in this bill, and this isn't about blanket immunity. Businesses have to be trying to follow government guidelines and standards, and that's when they have the protections that are in place in this bill. And so, again, this isn't about blanket immunity. This is about providing certainty for businesses and asking them to do the right thing in exchange for those protections. And with that, I close and I ask you support this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Oh, Ms. Johnson, will you take a question, please? Representative Smith for a question.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and thank you, Ms. Johnson, for the presentation. It's good to see you. I haven't had a chance to look at the 10 lawsuits that have been filed so far in the state of Florida related to COVID in the last year. Could you, are any of those 10 lawsuits, are they against small businesses? Could you characterize what that litigation is?
Ms. Johnson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Smith. It's good to see you. And I loved your comments surrounding medical malpractice and the necessity for that. Didn't know you were such a defender of our medical malpractice system. So there's actually more than 10 cases, and I know William Large could speak more to that, but one of my favorite cases that I've seen is a case out of Indian Shores, Florida, and there's a guy who decided to travel over the 4th of July holiday He had cancer, has cancer, unfortunately for him, and he ate outside, and he went to go use the bathroom at a place called, doesn't matter what the place is called, but it is a small business, Caddy's. And he went inside, and he said nobody was wearing a mask sitting down. He did not catch COVID, but is suing this small business for over $1 million for pain and suffering because of the fear of getting COVID. And so that's just one of the many examples of, you know, some of the claims that we're seeing out there.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you.
Joy Ryan, America's Health Insurance Plans, a proponent. On behalf of all of her clients, so she's America's Health Insurance, just the one, okay, thank you. Stephen Kane, Florida Justice Association, an opponent. Mr. Kane, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I rise in opposition to House Bill 7. My name's Stephen Kane. I am a member of the Florida Justice Association, currently the secretary of the organization. I had hoped to speak on Representative Driscoll's amendment, but I think it's appropriate to address some of the comments that were made during the affidavit discussion. I am a medical malpractice practitioner. This is not apples to apples. This is indeed, Representative Driscoll, apples to oranges. What a doctor does, what a physician does in a medical malpractice case, is they review the medical records, which is typically the entirety of what we need to establish a case. A physician can review those medical records because they're trained to. They know what to look for. They know what the standard of care is. So they can actually attest to what they're required to attest to in a medical malpractice setting, unlike in a situation like this. All a physician can attest to is simply that this person had COVID and they had it during the time period that's covered by the lawsuit. You need facts. Experts don't rely on hypotheticals. They don't rely on assumptions. We don't have testimony before we start a suit. So the affidavit requirement in this bill is very problematic, and I thought Representative Driscoll had a good fix. I was very encouraged to hear Representative McClure, his openness to continue discussing this bill and trying to work the language, because I'm a small business owner. I represent over 3,000, as the FJA represents over 3,000 lawyers that are also small business owners. We want to open right. We've tried to open right, but as the bill stands right now, there's too many questions. Representative Jenny pointed out some of the questions with regards to good faith and substantial compliance. And I would add substantial compliance with what? There is no definition. There is no limitation. I think businesses want guidelines. They want to open safely. I think the majority of our businesses in the great state of Florida are trying to do the right thing. My firm has one of the six cases that have been filed in the state related to COVID liability. That case was brought on behalf of a Publix worker who was refused, was denied, along with the other workers, to wear a mask that all of us are wearing here today. His children bought him masks, encouraged him to wear it at work, but Publix refused to allow it because they didn't want to scare customers away. Those aren't the kind of actors we want to protect. I don't think that's the intent of Representative McClure, and in Chairman Leek's comments earlier, I think we all have a similar goal. I want businesses that are doing things responsibly to be protected. But this bill goes simply too far. It encourages negligent businesses. The other issue with this bill there's two other issues, the gross negligence standard, that really hasn't been addressed today. Hopefully in future committees we'll get to address that and work with Representative McClure. But effectively, that would require a business commit homicide. I mean, that's the standard in the criminal setting, would be manslaughter. That would be the equivalent of what this standard is talking about in this bill, if you want to put it in the context of a criminal setting. And the other issue is essentially the judge is being asked to step into the role that is historically preserved for a jury. We're essentially going to be trying this case twice, once to the judge, and then when we prove our case to the judge and he allows it to go forward, then we've got to go prove it to the jury. And the burden that's being placed on folks who've been injured because of businesses who've done the wrong thing is insurmountable. I think this bill, as it's currently written, and I know it's not your intention, Representative McClure, is a complete bar to the courthouse for folks who've been injured or killed because of egregious conduct by businesses. And there are very few of those cases out there. Our organization, we've spoken with our attorneys. Not many people are even contemplating these cases. And those that have heard about them, you see what we've got, a total of 6 cases. You're going to hear higher numbers. A lot of those are business-to-business or federal cases that aren't covered by Florida law that won't be impacted by this legislation. We would encourage the members of the committee to vote no on this bill in case it does move forward. I look forward to working with Representative McClure, Chairman Leak, and the other members to try and make this bill better, something that we can all be proud of and something that the business community can feel confident in reopening. I think most of the businesses want to reopen safely. So we would encourage you to vote no on this bill, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Kane? Thank you, Mr. Kane. Good to see you. William Large, Florida Justice Reform Institute. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. William Large, Florida Justice Reform Institute. We rise in support of this bill. I want you all to know that we studied this issue over the summer. We got input from experts from around the state to give us commentary. And likewise, we had the opportunity, because COVID really hit and captured the public's imagination right in the February-March timeframe. Many other states have passed COVID-19 legislation since that time. Our research reveals that 32 states in the District of Columbia have passed COVID-19 liability legislation. 17 of those states address exposure cases like this bill addresses here today. Some of those states passed that through an executive order by their governor, like Alabama, Arkansas, and Pennsylvania. But our executive is limited in its power, and therefore we need the policymaking branch of government, the legislature, to do that. Other states looked at raising safeguards. Those were like Michigan, those were like Kansas, Oklahoma. Other states raised the bar in terms of gross negligence or a clear and convincing standard. Those were like Georgia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. So what you're doing is not unusual. Other states have done this since you all were last here last March and had left that last week in March when things really began to capture the public's attention on COVID-19 legislation. Essentially, I also want you to understand that I don't believe that anything in this bill is a bar to bringing a lawsuit. I do believe it increases the burden from a greater weight of the evidence. That would be like if there's 50 pounds on each side and you add a feather, that would be the feather would add, and that would be the burden that the plaintiff would have to make. You have a clear and convincing standard that's higher, but it's not a bar to a courtroom. And a gross negligence standard is not a bar to a courtroom as well. And I want to make sure that you understand what a gross negligence standard is. It's that a reasonably prudent person would know is likely to result in the injury of another. It's not willful or wanton. So because of that, we think that this bill is very well thought out. It follows what a lot of other states have done, and we support this good bill by Representative McClure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Large. Jake Farmer, Florida Retail Federation. Mr. Farmer, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Jake Farmer, Florida Retail Federation. On behalf of all of our retailers across Florida, the small ones, the large ones, we'd like to thank the representative for this good bill. We believe this will allow our local retailers to safely reopen and fully recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. And with that, I'd ask for your favorable support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farmer. Brewster Bevis, Associated Industries of Florida, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much, and I will be brief. I would like to thank the sponsor of this good piece of legislation. Look, I think, like many in this room, when this pandemic first appeared, I, for myself, thought, man, you know, by summer, we're going to be through this. However, here we are 11, 12 months later. We're still in the midst of this pandemic. Thankfully, we had a governor that did not just fully lock down this state. However, during that time, many companies and many businesses have shut their doors. However, many more have grinded through. Many employers have not brought home a paycheck because they wanted to pay their employees. Now we see a light at the end of the tunnel. That light might be a little bit far off, but it's there. Our businesses are continue to grind away. We believe this piece of legislation will give them a little bit of peace of mind at night to where they can rest a little bit easier, knowing that they have a little bit of protection as they operate their business. I believe this will help curtail sue-to-settle lawsuits as well. So we do support this piece of legislation. Now, I will end with this, and it's something that was said by an opponent of the bill in another committee. And I bring it up because it really gets to the heart of this. And I quote, this was said, I quote, "We are not going after the corner pizzeria because they don't have any money." And then went down a laundry list of all Florida big businesses. Ding, ding, ding. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Now we know what it's about. It's about money. It's not about providing recourse to these potentially infected people. We're not going after them because they don't have any money. And right there, I think, is a perfect reason why this bill needs to be enacted into law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Bevis. Ida Escamani, Florida Rising. Ms. Escamani, you're recognized.
Good afternoon, members. My name is Ida V. Escamani, not to be confused with your colleague, my twin sister, Representative Anna Escamani. And I want to first start by thanking the sponsor for his time and so being open to dialogue. We greatly appreciate that. I represent Florida Rising. We are a statewide racial and economic justice organization. We do stand in opposition to the bill as currently written. And for us, it's also about working people. Throughout these last 10 months, we've worked very closely with workers of several sectors who've had to make that tough decision between their health and their safety and their paycheck. This includes farm workers, healthcare workers, multi-generational folks, seniors, and young folks who work at grocery stores across the state, restaurant servers, teachers, families of those who are incarcerated. These are working families. These are essential people who are already living paycheck to paycheck in this state. Many of these workers work for employers that do not provide earned sick time. They don't provide hazard pay. They don't qualify for unemployment if they choose to leave for their own safety. And of course, we know that that $275 a week doesn't cut it anyway. We feared this legislation would make it more difficult for these workers, for consumers, and especially those most vulnerable, folks who we've seen have been disproportionately impacted by this pandemic, as people of color and low-income folks, to seek justice in cases of this and to hold those bad actors accountable, both in business and in government. If this legislation is designed to protect those small businesses and those faith institutions and those nonprofits, then perhaps we can consider an amendment to narrow the scope of the bill to those entities. If we truly cherish the essential worker, those heroes, we should re-examine this bill, in our opinion. We ask that this body focus on those policies that looks out for the little guy, the folks that need an advocate, and that we hope that this legislature looks at economic prosperity as also including worker safety and salaries and their rights, as well as the success of our businesses. And together, we think we all can thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Escamani. I'm now going to read into the record those who are waving in support or opposition. Christopher Dudley, Florida State Alliance of YMCA, waves in support. David Cruz, Florida League of Cities, waves in support. Angela Bonds, American Sport Fishing Association, waves in support. Angela Bonds for the Florida Association of RV Parks and Campgrounds, Inc., waves in support. Angela Bonds, Florida Recreational Vehicle Trade Association, waves in support. Timothy Meenan, NAIFA, Florida Inc., waves in support. Ted Smith, Florida Automobile Dealers Association, waves in support. Justin Thames, Florida Institute of Certified Public Accountants, waves in support. Amanda Bowen, Manufacturers Association of Florida, waves in support. Alex Miller, Florida Trucking Association, waves in support. James Mosteller, Foundation of for Florida's Future, waves in support. Kelly Millett, Florida Apartment Association, waves in support. Ronald Book, 7-Eleven Inc., waves in support. Ronald Book, AutoNation Inc., waves in support. Oh, here we go. Change it up a little bit. Kerry Boyd, SBLC Action Fund, waves in opposition. Seeing no more public testimony, is there any debate on the bill? Representative Driscoll, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And thank you to all of the presenters who came forth and shared your perspective on the bill. I think it's good for us as committee members to hear that and be mindful of those things as this bill continues from bill stop to bill stop. And I know that we'll continue speaking with Representative McClure to try to make this a better bill. While I don't think that the intention of the bill lacks a sense of nobility, I think it is a wise thing for us to think about what we can do to, as Mr. Templin make sure that we can have a good business climate in Florida. I think that there are aspects of this bill that are just out of balance and that our procedural quirks, including this affidavit process and having the trial before the trial. So I hope that we can continue talking about it because it's just not quite where it needs to be. But I am optimistic that we can strike that balance. But I do especially want to thank the members of the public today who provided testimony about how workers have been affected during this pandemic. It's been a difficult time and stressful for us all, and I think it's incumbent on us as members of the legislature who've been away all of these months to remember to take the workers into account as well as we think through how to provide the types of relief that our state so desperately needs right now. And for those reasons, because I don't think that this bill is fully baked just yet, I'm down on it today, but I do look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative Smith, in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McClure, for your openness in talking to us about the various concerns that we have around this bill. You know, I have a lot of concerns around the affidavit process, as you know. I just don't understand why we are requiring a doctor to sign off on non-medical findings. I mean, we are asking the doctors to not only sign off on, you know, whether the patient was, you know, positive with COVID or not, which is easy to affirm, but asking them to sign off on the defendant's culpability, their omissions, their actions, without any kind of investigation, without any kind of findings of fact. You know, I just don't understand what doctor is going to want to sign off on non-medical findings or get involved in litigation like we're asking them to do here. The comparison to MedMal keeps coming up. But again, in MedMal, they are being asked to sign an affidavit on medical findings, things that these doctors know and understand based on all of the medical evidence that has been presented. And even in that case, the overwhelming public necessity for there to be this pretrial evidence, this pretrial affidavit, these pretrial findings, the overwhelming public necessity there is the unique situation is doctors not being able to find insurance and high patient costs. Here, we're being told the overwhelming public necessity is fear and anxiety. It's not lots of litigation because we're not seeing that. It's not lawsuit after the next lawsuit after the next lawsuit. We're not seeing any of that either. And what we're also doing is we are unfortunately implicating the constitutional right to access the court because we've taken what's already a really high standard to prove culpability in this case even higher. I think to almost an impossibly high standard, which would affect someone's ability to access the court for rightful damages. And I just want to close with, you know, we see in the whereas clauses and how the bill is being talked about publicly that this is the big COVID relief that businesses have been waiting for 11 months. We've been going through this for a year, and we finally have the relief that businesses need. This is not relief for small businesses. It's not. I hear from my small businesses in my community every day, and what they tell me is that they need relief in the form of commercial rent that they can't pay, direct relief to pay their bills. They need direct relief to be able to retain their employees because of the economic consequences of COVID. We come back to them at the end of session, and we tell them that we passed, you know, this bill, and we frame it as relief. They're not buying it. The small businesses are not buying it because they're not being sued. And they're not up at night worried about a lawsuit that's not coming. They're worried about how are they going to pay their commercial rent and retain their employees and hold on to their business that they worked their whole lives for. So I'm going to be down on the bill, but I look forward to actually legitimately talking to the bill sponsor. Rhett McClure, you've been great at trying to find alternatives, especially with the plaintiff, or I'm sorry, for the affidavit process, because I think that there's an opportunity there, and I look forward to continuing that dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mariano on debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this great bill today. I've heard many mentions throughout this committee that this bill leaves out our workers, but I believe this bill protects our workers by protecting our small businesses and helping keep them employed. So I would encourage you to all consider that as we move forward. The sponsor has shown that he is willing to work on any of the logistical issues that anyone may see, but just think that this bill is going to help protect our workers, not hurt them.
Thank you. Ranking Member Casello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to thank Rep. McClure for his transparency and his willingness to work with the members as this bill moves forward in committee. Unfortunately, as the bill is written today, I'll be voting down on it, but look forward to the dialogue that you seem so open to have. I think that's a good sign. And I think the bones and the concept is there. I think it just needs some fine tweaking. So I appreciate bringing forward. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Thompson in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McClure. One of my concerns is that I don't believe we should reward bad actors. And this bill would financially benefit businesses who won't face liability when they have not taken the appropriate precautions to protect not only their workers, but also their customers. And the bill will increase costs for people who are injured by irresponsible business practices who can't recover. And I still have issues with regard to access to the courts and the constitutional issues that I mentioned before. And though you mentioned that if businesses don't put forth a good faith effort, when I ask what is the incentive for them to follow the standards, you said they would be liable, but I didn't really hear under what circumstances and how that liability would come about. So I think some of those things have to be addressed before I would be able to support the bill. But thank you.
Thank you, members. I've considered this bill a great deal, and if you want to help people, let them go to work. If they're going to go back to work, then they have to have a place to go to work. And if they're going to have a place to go to work, then you're going to have to provide the employers some reasonable safeguards that they're not going to get hit with an onslaught of litigation. That's precisely what this bill does, and I hope that you support it. With that, Representative McClure, would you like to close on your bill?
I think you just did, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
I look forward to working with not only all the stakeholders, but members. Let's work on the affidavit. Let's see if there's a way to make it a little better, get folks comfortable with it. Right to the courts. Let's sit down and talk about it, Representative. I'm on board to have the discussion. My goodness, it's 2021. I think we all are on Zoom every waking minute, so we can certainly get in touch with each other, and let's do it and find a way. With that, I close.
Thank you, Representative McClure. DJ, please call the roll on HB 7 and announce the vote.
Representative Bell has been excused. Byrd?
Yes.
Cosello?
No.
Clemens?
Yes.
Driscoll?
No.
Gilombardo?
Yes.
Goff Marcil? Jenny? Mariano?
Yes.
McFarland?
Yes.
Payne?
Yes.
Smith?
No.
Snyder?
Yes.
Thompson? Tribulsi?
Yes.
Williamson?
Yes.
Zika?
Yes.
Chair Leak?
Yes.
11 yeas, 6 nays.
Thank you. Show the bill reported favorably. Representative McClure, good job. Folks, if I may have a point of personal privilege here. On Friday, one of my good friends and business partners passed away from COVID. I want to recognize Kendall McEachern of Accenturia for all of the work and a life well lived. And I also would like to take a moment of silence for all of those who have had loved ones who have passed and all of those who have passed. So if you would join me in a moment of silence. Thank you, members. And with that, Representative Driscoll moves we rise. Unless there is an objection upon the motion of Representative Driscoll, the meeting is adjourned.